From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of the New Yorker and WNYC Studios.
I take out my hearing aids.
They are.
And put on the cans.
Right, yes, and they're on the line for you now.
They're there now.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I can hear. Is anybody there?
So, David, it's David Remnick from the New Yorker magazine. How are you?
How nice to meet you. How are you?
I'm terrific, and all the better for talking to you. If you don't recognize who that voice belongs to, it's David Attenborough. He's been documenting the world and its creatures for 60 years, and in Britain, he's often called a national treasure.
In a far corner of Southeast Asia lies the Coral Triangle. A cluster of the richest coral reefs in the world. Undersea cities crammed full of life.
Attenborough's films are impeccably researched. They're ambitiously filmed and executed with style and imagination, and they set an incredibly high bar for nature documentaries in our time. His latest project is a 7-part survey of the oceans called Planet Earth, Blue Planet 2. It captures aspects of the animal world that you've never seen before. Fish that use tools and eat birds. An octopus building itself an armor of discarded seashells. And even if you're not a great animal lover or a nature documentary buff, Attenborough will make you think long and hard about what it is to be human and our place in the world. Sir David, I have to tell you, over the past weekend, a long weekend, I just watched and watched and watched the world of the ocean. It was an incredible experience. And over the past over the past 60 years, you've told the story of life on Earth from every continent, every habitat, and have probably documented as many animals as Linnaeus. What gives you the perpetual sense of awe about the natural world?
Well, I suppose infinite variety is what gives you awe. I mean, the fact that there is almost every problem has had more solutions to it by the evolution than you can imagine. It doesn't matter what it is, whether it's chewing vegetation or whether it's flying or whether it's concealing yourself. There is an infinity of answers that the natural history has produced. And one of the great astonishments is why there are so many of them are so beautiful. I suppose we're not time to get too hoity-toity about it all, but I mean, why butterflies are so beautiful is a matter of awe.
It's a good question. And why a sea slug is so beautiful? Who knew? I have to tell you,
yes, Anna,
to start this conversation, I'm a confirmed city boy. I go by the terrible rubric of I am at two with nature. Nature is not something that's natural to me.
But then I'm the same. I'm a city boy. I was brought up in a city in Leicester in the middle of England. And perhaps it is the city people who haven't grown up with the natural world as intimately as country boys, for whom that perception of awe comes as so bewitching an emotion, a response.
Now, this has been 6 decades of making these films. I have to ask, of all the creatures you've seen, what sticks out in your mind as the strangest and most beautiful and incomprehensible?
Well, those are the conflicting adjectives. But one of the things in Blue Planet, which I never cease to wonder about and take joy from, is a creature called the weedy sea dragon. It occurs in the waters of South Australia. It's like a seahorse, and it swims not vertically with its body vertical, but horizontally. And it's disguised as seaweed to a simply unbelievable degree. I mean, its limbs and its flanks and its tail and its eyebrows and one thing and another, they're all like bits of seaweed. You can't tell the difference. And then they have this wonderful dance in which the male courts the female. And then the female, having got the eggs being fertilized, the female hands over the eggs to the male and he looks after them. The whole business is Disney-esque. I mean, it is quite unbelievable.
Are there any creatures that you can't stand?
I don't care for rats, I have to say. I mean, I've had rats run over my face when I'm asleep, and that's not fun.
Where did
I've
that
even
happen?
Had rats.
Not at home.
Where?
I
yeah. In the Solomons, yes, in the Solomon Islands, sleeping on a... Yeah, it's not too good. And I've had rats leap out of the loo as you're sitting on the loo and they come up between your thighs. That is not to be recommended either.
Oh, I'm having a moment. And when you're crafting a story about a creature, do you look for the animal's most essential characteristic or the characteristic which is most, you know, I hate to say the use of the word, but relatable to the person watching at home?
Well, I was going to say that the anthropomorphizing temptation is great, but actually we have got over the rather simplest view of this. I mean, when I was making these films 30 years ago, the idea that you credited any animal with any emotion that you might remotely call human was anathema. I mean, you thought, you mustn't do that, how unscientific. But the fact of the matter is that if you get to know a particular animal, then you begin to realize and study them, as you do when you're making films, you suddenly realize that they are different, you know. I mean, and that's not just monkeys and apes or even octopods. That happens to me with spiders. I remember very clearly there's a spider that occurs in the middle of the United States called a bolas spider, which it spins silk, it puts a little blob on the bottom of the thread, and then it whirls it like a bolas. I said to the cameraman, look, that's what it does, old boy, go away and do it and film it. And in due course, I went down there, it was in Georgia, I remember, and he had a number of milk bottles. He had 10 milk bottles in a line, and he had sprigs of vegetation in each one of them, and on each one of them there was a spider. He said, this one, he said, is absolutely hopeless. I mean, if you shine a light, she won't do anything at all. And the one next to it, it's not a question of light. She hates sound, and if I make a click or something, she stops. This one is just bone idle, never does anything at all. But that one, she's absolute darling. You just put a butterfly, put a moth anywhere near her, and she swings her bolas, and it's absolutely dead cert. You've got a great shot. Well, okay, spiders with individual personalities. Come on.
How did you first get addicted to this as a kid?
Finding fossils, I think. It's one of the mysteries, isn't it, that a lot of kids loved collecting things. All the great naturalists were, and natural scientists were collectors when they were boys. Darwin was absolutely obsessed with beetles. And I'm not putting myself in the same bracket as Darwin, but just collecting fossils in the Jurassic of the rocks where I grew up outside the city of Leicester, I used to find all these amazing things. I used to knock a rock with a hammer and then suddenly see it fall apart and realize that there was a most wonderfully beautiful shell, perfect in every detail, and that had not seen the light of day for 150 million years, and that mine were the first eyes ever for human eyes to fall on it. Well, that's thrilling.
Well, Darwin had a hammer. He had the ability to collect, but he didn't have the technology that you had in that making Blue Planet 2. What's gotten away? What animal has eluded your grasp or lens?
I could easily have answered that question to you 30 years ago. There were dozens of things. I mean, I remember writing into a script 20 years ago, a sequence about snow leopards. And then when they saw it, they said, look, nobody's ever filmed a snow leopard before, ever. And it's very, very rare, and it lives in very, very remote places. And so a blue pencil goes through that lot, because you can't, there's a limit to the amount of time and money you can spend on things. But now, a series called Planet Earth, we were able to get shots, we were able to put up, not even cameraman, we put up remote camera traps, unattended cameras, switched on by the action of this of the animal coming along, turning it on, taking pictures of it, spraying the rocks with urine, and then after 2 minutes when the animal had left, turning itself off. And we got a terrific sequence. So there are solutions now to almost everything you can think of. Even, I mean, in this series, we couldn't possibly have shown sea lions trapping a tuna, because the only way you could see how they actually did it was from the air. Well, 5 years ago, we couldn't have done that. Now we have drones, and we were able to send it up and get these extraordinary shots that nobody had ever seen before of sea lions doing just that, herding in these tuna into this bay, which is a cul-de-sac.
This time, when the shoal tries to escape, he blocks them and drives them back into the next blind alley. The gang can now pick them off, one by one.
There is no doubt that compared to all of your previous work, Blue Planet 2 makes the clearest statement about the peril that the world's oceans are in. In the final episode, you say, "For years we thought the oceans were so vast and the inhabitants so infinitely numerous that nothing we could do could have an effect on them. But now we know that was wrong." When you finish this project, you and your colleagues, a lot of colleagues, do you leave it with a sense of optimism or the opposite?
I don't think that either optimism or pessimism are the most appropriate words, really, because making a global generalization is a difficult thing to do. What it leaves me with is the thought that I can see problems that have got to be solved, and I think they have to be solved. We have to face up to them and have to do something about them. And that I couldn't look my grandchildren in the eyes if they said, "Granddad, you could see that was happening and you didn't tell anybody, or you didn't do anything about it, or you didn't mention it." That would be terrible. And there are things that can be done. There are instances for us to realise that we can do things. I mean, after all, we have saved the whales. It was pioneers who, 20, 30 years ago, got together the maritime nations of the world and saying, if we go on killing whales at the rate we're doing, we're going to exterminate them. And human beings from all around the world, governments got together and said, okay, then we will actually sort out this question. And indeed, in this last programme, we explained that sperm whales, which were on the verge of disappearing, nobody knew where they'd gone now or how many had gone, have suddenly come back, which is a marvellous demonstration that if you give the natural world just half a chance, it bounces back in an extraordinary way. That is what gives you optimism. What gives you pessimism, of course, is the fact that there are people who deny that it's happening.
Some of them are in very high office. So, David, how does this immersion in the natural world, in the animal world, in the ocean, affect your day-to-day view of human beings? How is it different than most of us walking along 8th Avenue or wherever we are?
Well, I suppose I mustn't talk about elevating or putting down. But you do realise that we're one. You do realise that the natural world, that life, this mysterious thing, which nobody's actually been able to identify, you can't define it. The difference between something that was just living 5 minutes ago and is not anymore is very difficult to define. And that's what that sort of mortality is what links us all.
I guess that's what I was going to ask, is how does it make you view the end of things for yourself or for your friends or for humanity?
Well, you know, you're part of it.
Yeah,
I mean, the things affect you in the same way as they affect you when you see watching any other kind of animal. The closer it comes, the more you're aware of it. And people say, "Do you think about death?" Of course, I think about death. Think about death every time you get up in the morning. But it's a matter of luck, isn't it? I mean, entire luck. I have, after all, contemporaries of mine who can't walk. I have contemporaries who can't even remember things. I mean, well, of course, I can't remember things, but I mean, most seriously, I can't remember things. And that is entirely a matter of luck. And so I can do these things. And not to do them, if you can do them, seems to be an act of extraordinary ingratitude.
Sir David, thank you very much. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you very much. Okay.
David Attenborough is the host of Planet Earth, Blue Planet 2, which is out on DVD and on various streaming services. Now we're going to stay in the water, or near the water at least, but this is not David Attenborough territory. This is a little stretch of the New York City shoreline called Dead Horse Bay. And that name is not at all figurative or metaphorical. This is where the city dealt with the bodies of horses in the days when that was a major sanitation effort. And the beach here, in fact, is still a garbage dump, but an interesting one if you're into that kind of thing.
Yeah, we're going to look at some old garbage. It's like my favorite thing. They built this city. So Google Maps used to have it called Dead Horse Bay, then Bottle Beach, and then I noticed this morning they changed it to Glass Bottle Beach.
Our guide on this excursion is Julia Wirtz, a cartoonist who does elaborate renderings of local geography and history, and she knows more nooks and crannies of New York City than anyone you'll ever meet.
We'll cross busy Flatbush, and then over to the left is the bridge that goes out to the Rockaways. See, these people are coming from there. She's got boots on. Hey, did you guys just come from Bottle Beach out there?
Yeah.
How was it?
Good. Yeah? Low tide, so lots out.
Okay, nice. Oh, yeah, you got your rain boots on?
Yeah, the trail's pretty good. Pretty cleared out, not too muddy, and there's lots of stuff on the beach right now. Lots of glass and bottles.
Okay.
Since it's low tide, so
great.
It should be in good shape. Have fun.
All right, yeah,
thanks.
Well, there'll be a little trail up here, kind of breaking through these trees. Used to come here, when I first came here, you kind of had to bushwhack your way through all of this forest land. So I started my career as a cartoonist, which is a lot of sitting indoors for 16 hours a day by yourself, listening to podcasts and watching TV. And I decided that I wanted to do something outdoors. And I had a friend who reintroduced me to exploring abandoned buildings. And I got consumed by it, and I quit my job, and I did nothing but that for 2 years. So Bottle Beach was one of my first places. I don't consider it urban exploring because it's not an abandoned building, but it's still an abandoned, forgotten area within New York City. Now we're emerging from the path, and you'll start to see some of the bottles. So a lot of these bottles, you can tell the different uses from them. Let's see, like this is soda. And there's a lot of cosmetic bottles. So see all of these, this milk glass, and usually they're still whole. These ones are my favorite, like little tiny brown ones. These are little apothecary bottles. They took Barren Island, which is where we are now, and they filled it in with garbage to connect it to Brooklyn. And in the 50s, all that garbage came flooding into the bay and has been washing up on the shore ever since. But you know, back then they didn't have plastics and all these things that are clogging up our landfills now that won't just kind of be reabsorbed by the earth. So pretty much all they had was leather and glass. And a lot of nylons. You'll see a lot of ladies' nylons wrapped up in these tree roots that are sticking out. From the 1800s, early 1900s, and it's all collected in this tree, which has toppled, so its roots are revealed, and it's just collecting all the nylons. Oh yeah, as soon as you touch it, it just kind of falls apart. Ugh. It's very beautiful, like I think so. Like all this glass, all this history just sort of scattered about in a broken way. And then you can see the lower toward the water you get, the more you actual whole bottles are. It's very rare to find silverware out here because that's one of the things that people scavenge for. But I brought my mom out here and I told her, like, look for silverware because often in the handle of old silverware, it'll be engraved where it's from. So there's like a lot of New York asylums. They had New York's property of New York City hospitals engraved into the handle. And I told my mom to keep an eye out, and I was like, oh, but you won't find any. And almost as soon as I finished that sentence, she pulled a spoon from just this pile of garbage, and it was the New York Department of Public Education, which I'd never seen before. She was ecstatic, and I was mad, because I have come out here for years looking for silverware, and she just found it in the blink of an eye. I don't need this. I don't need more stuff. I have to put it back. It belongs to the sea. I think my favorite part of coming down here actually is sitting quietly and listening to the water come in, because you can hear it, the tinkling noise of broken glass as the water comes in. Usually around dusk it sounds more, the ambient music. I used to take dates out here sometimes just to see how they would handle it. Like, if they didn't like it, if they thought it was gross and I just took them to a landfill, then I wouldn't ask them out on a second date. But if they were into it, then I knew that they were probably pretty cool. And maybe it would work out. For a long time, this sort of stuff didn't show up in my work, and I lived a sort of split life where I made comics about my daily life. So I was making comics about really boring daily things and then doing these spectacularly strange and exciting urban exploring things that I wasn't putting into comics, and I didn't know how to marry the two until I started doing comics for The New Yorker, which were about history. And then I realized that this is history, like Bottle Beach is history, so I could just make a comic about Bottle Beach and tie those two things together. So I do have comics about weird and forgotten places in New York.
So what is this?
So it's just like a wood, it's like a little turnkey right here. I have no idea what this is, but I like it. So it's, say it's like a handmade wood stick with a little platform on top and what looks like a little turnkey on side of that platform, and I have no idea what this is. I'm taking it home. This is my date, my treasure for the day. I said I wasn't going to take anything. I lied. I knew it. I knew it would happen.
Julia Wirtz at Glass Bottle Beach on the shore of Dead Horse Bay. I'm totally not making this up. You can check it out on Google Maps. And she's the author of Tenements, Towers, and Trash, an unconventional illustrated history of New York City. You're listening to the New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around. We've got one more story today, and it's about Rachel Carson. You know Carson as the author of one of the most influential books of the last century. Silent Spring helped to launch the environmental movement as we know it today. And through close observation and an incredible marshaling of detail, she built a case against the unchecked use of chemicals. And that case led to some of the most crucial federal laws on the environment. Carson didn't start out as an environmentalist. There was really no such thing at the time. She started as a nature writer with a very particular interest. Here's Rachel Carson, speaking in 1951.
I seem to have been born with a fascination for the sea. For years before I ever saw it, I thought about it, dreamed about it, and wondered what it would be like.
Carson's writings about the ocean were published in The New Yorker in the 1950s. And while these works were later overshadowed by Silent Spring, staff writer Jill Lepore thinks they contain the seeds of what made Carson so influential in her time. Here's actress Charlaine Woodard reading Rachel Carson.
In midsummer, life in the surface water slacks to a slower pace. The red jellyfish, Cyania, usually has grown from the size of a thimble to that of an umbrella. This great jellyfish moves through the sea with rhythmic pulsations, trailing long tentacles, and as likely as not, shepherding a little group of young cod or haddock, which find shelter under its bell and travel with it.
And here's Jill Lepore, a staff writer and a professor of history at Harvard.
So Rachel Carson was born nowhere near the sea. She was born near the Allegheny River in western Pennsylvania in 1907. She grew up on a kind of dilapidated farm. It wasn't really a working farm anymore. Her father was sort of a bit of a traveling salesman, but not a successful one. She went to college to become a poet. She was going to study English. She, though, changed her whole focus of her college education when she took a biology class. And She fell in love with her biology professor, became deeply passionately attached to this quite incredible woman, Mary Scott Skinker, and who spotted in young Rachel Carson something quite promising and special and managed to secure for her a summer position at Woods Hole on Cape Cod, this path-breaking oceanographic institute. This was 1928. She was 21 years old. She'd never seen or smelled the ocean before.
I had my first prolonged contact with the sea at the Marine Biological Laboratory at Woods Hole. There, I never tired of watching the tidal currents racing through the hole, that wonderful place of whirlpools and eddies and swiftly running water. And I loved to watch the waves breaking at Nobsca Point after a storm.
She didn't really know how to swim. She was terrified of boats. But there was something just so magical. Sort of, if you picture a little boy who always wanted to be an astronaut, kind of landing on Mars.
The summer sea may glitter with millions of moving pinpricks of light, like an immense swarm of fireflies. This effect is produced by a shoal of the brilliantly phosphorescent shrimp, Meganictithines, a creature of cold and darkness, and of the places where icy water rolls upwards from the depths and bubbles to the surface.
From that first summer at Woods Hole, Carson would roll up her pant legs and take off her shoes, and she would climb all over the shoreline. She would climb up and down the dunes. She would wade out into the water. She would be gone for hours upon hours upon hours. She would get up in the middle of the night to wander out to the beach with a flashlight looking for the nightlife.
I remember a moss-carpeted ledge jutting out from the rock wall over sea depths where laminarias rolled in with the tide. The moss was saturated, holding water as faithfully as a sponge. Down within the deep pile of that moss, I caught a glimpse of bright rosy color.
Carson became devoted to the study of the sea after that summer in Woods Hole, and she decided to go to a graduate school. She entered a PhD program at Johns Hopkins, a really ambitious thing for any woman to do. She started in 1932. We're in the depths of the Depression by now. Her family has no money. Her family is entirely dependent on her, and she's in graduate school. She moves to Baltimore, but her mother, her ailing father, her divorced sister, her sister's two really little children all come to live with her, and Carson has to support them. She works as a lab assistant. She teaches biology. She ends up leaving her PhD program with a master's degree and takes a job at the Bureau of Fisheries, where, unsurprisingly, she's hired to write brochures. The kinds of brochures they were putting together were, you know, about as interesting as the terms of service when you click on to a new app. Like, they're just really technical writing. They might explain the life cycle of a seagull, for instance. So she's writing brochures, and they have this just majesty. They're just this majestic, and they're intimate, and they're also shocking, and they're dramatic, and they have characters. But no one has heard anyone write about the sea like this before, certainly not the Bureau of Fisheries. And so her supervisor says, look, your writing is actually too good for these brochures. You should start sending it around. And her first breakthrough essay in 1937 is published in The Atlantic, which I always think is somehow fitting. And it knocked people's socks off.
People often seem to be surprised that a woman should have written a book about the sea. This is particularly true, I find, of men. Perhaps they have been accustomed for a long time to thinking about the more exciting fields of science as exclusively masculine domains. In fact, one of my correspondents a few days ago addressed me as Dear Sir, explaining that although he knew perfectly well that I was a woman, he simply could not bring himself to acknowledge the fact.
Tide pools contain within their depths mysterious worlds where all the beauty of the sea is subtly portrayed in miniature. I remember one so small that as I lay outstretched on the rocks beside it, I could easily touch its far shore. Its floor was paved with mussels. Their shells were a soft color, the misty blue of distant mountain ranges, and their presence gave an illusion of depth. The water in which they lived was so clear as to be invisible to my eyes. I could detect the interface between air and water only by the sense of coldness on my fingertips. This crystal water was filled with sunshine, an infusion and distillation of light that reached down and surrounded each of the small and resplendent shellfish with its glowing radiance.
Carson complained a lot about the way people wrote about the sea and the way they wrote about nature, which was they made a catalog of things. And there'd be no relationship between one thing and the other, between the environment and the creature.
The shells of the mussels provided a place of attachment for the only other life that I could see in the pool. Fine as the finest threads, the basal stems of colonies of hydroids traced their faintly discernible lines across the shells. The hydroids belonged to the group called Sertularia, in which each individual of a colony and all the supporting and connecting branches are enclosed in transparent sheaths, like a tree in winter after an ice storm.
She saw, when she looked down into a tide pool, how everything was attached to everything else, how everything was dependent on everything else.
I lay beside the pool, and with my hand lens, brought the hydroids into clearer view. They seemed to me to look nothing so much as pieces of exquisite cut glass, each of them, perhaps, a segment of an intricately wrought chandelier. On what, I wondered, were all these Sertularians, carnivorous like all hydroids, feeding? From their very abundance, I knew that whatever creatures served them as food must be many times more abundant than the hydroids themselves. Yet I could see nothing. Then, somewhere in the crystal clarity of the pool, my eye detected...
So you can picture Carson there lying on her stomach with her face pressed into that tide pool. That's how she gains and captures your attention, bringing you intimately into that world and giving you this tour of it from what appears to be the most vulnerable, tiniest, most insignificant piece of this tiny, tiny little tide pool and showing you step by step how you too are tied to them.
Yet I knew that it was only the imperfection of human vision that prevented me from seeing the microscopic hordes of water fleas, copepods, and worms on which the hydroids were preying with those groping, searching tentacles that were themselves barely discernible. Even more than the visible life in the pool, the life I could not see came to dominate my thoughts. And finally, the members of that invisible throng seemed to me the most powerful beings in the pool. Both the hydroids and the mussels were utterly dependent on this invisible flotsam of the tide streams. The mussels as passive strainers of plant plankton, the hydroids as active predators seizing and ensnaring microscopic animals. And should the plankton become less plentiful? Should the incoming tide stream somehow become drained of this life? Then the pool would become a pool of death, both for the mussels in their shells blue as mountains, and for the crystal coolness of the hydroids.
So what Carson does so effectively here is communicate just how important are things that we can't see. She's teaching a reader who might wonder about whether invisible things matter, that they do matter. And that's really the same insight that she communicates that she brings to her most famous work, Silent Spring, which appears in 1962, but which Carson had been thinking about since 1945.
The chemicals to which life is asked to make its adjustment are no longer merely the calcium and silica and copper and the rest of the minerals washed out of the rocks and carried in rivers to the sea. They are also the synthetic creations of man's inventive mind. Brewed in his laboratories and having no counterparts in nature. To adjust to these chemicals would require time on the scale that is nature's. It would require not merely the years of a man's life, but the life of generations.
Carson would say about the chemical companies that they thought that they could repeal the balance of nature. That you couldn't repeal the balance of nature any more than you could rescind the law of gravity. That this audacity of chemists and scientists in trying to conquer nature with these pesticides was wrongheaded. And she made that claim with great temerity and determination at a time when she herself was suffering from cancer. She had been diagnosed with breast cancer. She'd had a radical mastectomy. She'd had radiation. She was quite ill. She was considerably hobbled. She'd lost her hair. She was often in a wheelchair. And yet she hid her illness from the whole world, went before Congress to testify, did her best to get her claims out into the world, and began planning her next project. She wanted to go back after Silent Spring to writing about the sea.
Curious changes have been taking place, with many animals invading the cold temperate zone from warmer waters and pushing up through Maine and even into Canada.
She'd noticed, as many scientists had begun to notice by the 1950s, that the world's oceans were getting warmer.
This phenomenon is clearly related to the widespread change of climate that is now well recognized. A general warming up having been noticed first in the Arctic regions, then in the subarctic, and more recently in the temperate areas of the northern states.
We tend to think the debate about climate change is a recent debate, or that the observation that the seas are rising is a new thing. But this is something Carson noticed in the 1950s.
One of the most impressive examples of this northward movement is provided by the green crab, once unknown north of the Cape, but now well known to every clam fisherman in Maine because of its habit of preying on the young states of the clam. At the beginning of this century, zoological manuals gave its range from New Jersey to Cape Cod. In 1905, it was reported near Portland. And by 1930, specimens had been collected in Hancock County, about midway along the Maine coast.
I picture Rachel Carson sitting in her house on an island in Maine, looking down at the shore, puzzling over the rising of the seas decades and decades ago. And it's painful. It's painful to picture that and think about what might have been if she hadn't died. Just embarking on this study, this inquiry, wondering what was causing the oceans to get warmer and these species to migrate. At a time when she had a tremendous purchase on American politics, on international politics, she had a kind of authority that scientists don't have anymore. What would that book have done in the world?
Looking down into the small world that is limited by the walls of the cave, I feel the rhythms of the greater sea world. It is the green sponges lining the pool that, for me, give this cave a special quality, a sense of the continuing flow of time. As I watch, a fish swims in, a shadow in the green lights. Compared to the ancient sponges, the fish is almost a symbol of modernity. Its ancestry traceable only half as far back into the past. And I, whose eyes behold the images of the two as though they were my contemporaries, am a mere newcomer, whose ancestors inhabited the earth so briefly that my present seems somehow anachronistic. And as I lie looking into the cave and thinking these thoughts, the surge of waters rises and floods across the rock behind me. The tide is rising.
That's Charlaine Woodard reading from the work of Rachel Carson, and we heard from staff writer Jill Lepore, whose new amazing history of the United States is called These Truths. She'll join me on the show again soon to discuss the book. I'm David Remnick. Thanks for joining us on the New Yorker Radio Hour. I hope we'll see you next time.
Rachel Carson's writing was used by permission of her estate. Carson's books include The Sea Around Us, The Edge of the Sea, and Under the Sea Wind. Her writings about the ocean will also be available in an upcoming volume from the Library of America. Special thanks to Andy Lancet of the WNYC Archives. The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.
Hi, this is David Remnick. We've just launched a new project that I want to tell you about, the New Yorker's Midterms 2018 newsletter. Every week, our writers and editors will check in from the campaign trail to tell you exactly what's happening across the country and why it matters. The newsletter is only running through the November midterm elections, so sign up now at newyorker.com/midterms newsletter. That's newyorker.com/midterms newsletter.